underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. What if an empire of Jewish warriors that really existed in the Middle Ages had never fallen and was the only thing standing between Hitler and his conquest of Russia? Emily Barton's new novel, The Book of Esther, is a saga of war, technology, mysticism, power, and faith. She is the author of Brookland and The Testament of Yves Gundren. She has received grants from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Emily Barton to this week's book show.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program again. The name of the new novel is The Book of Esther. What brought you to want to create this world?
Well, you know, it's a little bit complicated. I think that whenever writers are sure that they have a solid answer to that question, it may be a somewhat invented answer. I had been writing a novel that, among other things, took place in Berlin in 1933 and featured a Jewish typesetter who was kind of struggling with Hitler's various proclamations about typography. So I was thinking a lot about Jewish culture in Europe during Hitler's rise to power and during the war. And I had been thinking about the Khazars for a while because my husband converted to Judaism. And when he did that, we started learning about historical conversions to Judaism. So they had kind of been on my mind, but maybe not in the forefront of my mind. And then there came a day, actually, when I was teaching at Bard that I slipped on the ice and I broke my wrist. And it was right at the beginning of the winter break. And suddenly I had 5 weeks of writing time that I was planning to use working on that novel, but I had a broken wrist and I couldn't type, and I had been writing the novel on the computer. So my husband said, well, do you want to work on something else for a while? And I said, I don't think so. No, that's a nice idea, but... And he said, well, what if I dare you to write a 50,000-word potboiler in the next month? And I thought, oh, well, if it's a pot boiler, I can probably do it and I'll just write it by hand. It'll be so easy. And the thing that immediately sprang into my mind was that I wanted to have Khazars versus Nazis. Like, that was the pot boiler that, you know, that sprang into my mind. And it became immediately clear to me that it wasn't a pot boiler, but that, I think, was how it happened.
It seems, and I have no, absolutely no research to back up what I'm about to say, but it seems as though that would be a rare thing for people to immediately think of.
Well, unless, you know, sometimes you have the little pieces, the little imaginative bits kind of lurking around in your subconscious, and something happens that ignites them. And I think that might be what happened.
So before we talk about the novel in depth, bring me to the type of novel that you like to create in giving us an alternate history and creating your own world.
Mm-hmm. I think that my two previous novels, Brookland and The Testament of Yves Gundren, are both books that reimagine history from this invented perspective. They're absolutely alternate histories. They sometimes may look to readers as if they are in fact historical fiction in a more straightforward sense. When Brookland came out, I got lots of letters asking about what kind of research I'd done into various old Brooklyn families. And I did do a little bit of research, but also I did a certain amount of making stuff up. And the thing that I'm excited about the Book of Esther is that it's more obvious to readers that I made up a lot of this stuff, that it is in fact an alternate history in every sense. It's not recreating historical events for the most part that actually occurred. So my hope is that reading this book might help readers access that kind of hidden element of the earlier books that I wrote.
With that said, how much did you want to rely on Jewish history?
Well, it's a complicated question. You know, the question of how a writer of my generation would write about the Holocaust is, I think, a very lively question. Mm-hmm. I didn't live through it. My family that I know of was safely already in the United States when it happened. My father's father was in the Navy in World War II, but he was stationed in the South Pacific. He was not in the European theater. And being respectful of the true experiences that people had, people who are still alive today, is very important to me. At the same time, I wanted to find a new way of looking at that history in writing this novel. And I think that there are a lot of things about Jewish life and Jewish practice that are based in our world or that are closely related to the way we do it in our world in this book. But there are also other things that seem kind of newly invented to me.
I was reading an article about this book in Tablet magazine, and the piece starts off with the line that Jewish writers have had an ambivalent relationship with the genre of fantasy. Mm-hmm. Do you subscribe to that? And if so, why do you believe that's the case?
That is such an interesting question. I think that certainly if you go back to Theodor Herzl, that Jewish writer in the beginning of the 20th century had a very positive relationship with fantasy. And certainly I think of writers like Cynthia Ozick and of Michael Chabon, who rewrite Jewish history in sometimes somewhat fantastical but psychologically very truthful ways. So if by ambivalent the writer means complex and nuanced, yes, then I agree with it. But if by ambivalent that means negative, I'm not sure that's always true.
After I read the book, I was thinking it brought to mind Michael Chabon's The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Mm-hmm. And I see in several reviews that also has been the case. And I'm wondering if you felt that was that book was in any way something that you admired in a sense.
Yeah, you know, I had the pleasure of reviewing that book for the New York Observer when it first came out.
Yes.
So I read it twice in order to write a thoughtful review, and I enjoyed it so much. The first time through, I think I enjoyed it just because of its bravura, and the second time through, I really saw what he was doing, the ways in which genres collide and clash, the ways in which he invents things and kind of riffs on things that really do exist or might have existed, and his obvious delight in doing that has been very inspiring to me and gave me a certain amount of courage to go ahead and do what I wanted to do here. His other novel, not his only other novel, but Michael Chabon has also written a novel called Gentlemen of the Road,
right,
which has some characters who are Khazars. And when I began writing this book, I wrote to him and asked if he had any good source information, because there didn't seem to me to be that much known about these people. And I had a couple books, but did he know of anything else? And he wrote back basically to say, you know what, that's what's so wonderful for us as writers about writing about these people in this place, is that not that much is known, and you are free to go ahead and make things up.
So, of course, there is a Book of Esther. So at what point did you want to at least have that be your compass, if you will?
The biblical Book of Esther is a really marvelous text. Like many of the books of the Bible, or maybe I would say all of them, it's kind of reticent. You know, it has points to make about things, but mm-hmm. they're open to interpretation. It doesn't say a whole lot and leaves it to you. So Esther herself, Queen Esther in the Bible, is an inspiring figure to me. She begins by hiding her identity in order to marry the king of Persia. She is primarily, it seems, chosen for that role because she's beautiful, not because of any, you know, great merit other than that on her part. But over the course of the story of the biblical book of Esther, she comes to understand more about her position in the world of the court of Persia. And when she has an opportunity, either just to save herself or to save the whole Jewish people, she puts her life on the line and stands up for everyone she's related to, even though this means outing her secret to her husband, the king of Persia. I may not have said earlier that she hides her identity as a Jew in order to marry him. And so her willingness to own up to that fact and just to say who she is and to save all of the people instead of just herself is very inspiring to me. And so she was definitely an exemplar and a kind of an imaginative muse in thinking about how to write this story.
So when it comes to the story, and without me blowing it and giving things away, how do you describe the story that you wanted to tell?
I think that if you were to ask me what kind of a book this is, mm-hmm. I would tell you that it is first and foremost an adventure story.
Sure.
That it has battles and danger and all kinds of fanciful inventions that happen in this book. There are bat-winged biplanes, there are golems, there are mechanical horses, which kind of, you know, they're kind of like Vespas with hooves, but they also kind of seem like they have personalities. You know, there's all this stuff going on in this adventure story. But even while the adventure story is barreling forward, the book is always pulling back a little bit to ask the kinds of questions that adventure stories don't always have the time to ask. Questions about what it means to be a person and who decides that. Questions like that.
I'm hoping you can read for us a portion of the book and set up what you're going to read, which is about a third of the way through the novel.
Absolutely. I will read to you a passage that takes place just before a transformative moment in the narrative, when Esther, the main character, has decided to try to immerse herself in a mikveh, which is a ritual pool, in order to try to transform herself, to make a magical change to the kind of person she is. A mikveh was a powerful thing. It purified wives of their monthly uncleanness so they could return to their husbands. It cleansed those same husbands after they'd enjoyed their wives. It made the kala, the bride, ready for her wedding. It transformed the adopted child, whose ancestry was unknown, into a member of Avraham's tribe. It changed the convert from a ger toshav, a righteous stranger, into a Jew. When Kagan Bulan had converted this whole nation, three rituals had been required: a mass circumcision of all the males, old and young, an enormous Beit Din or rabbinical council to examine each individual on his knowledge of the law and his level of observance, and a great mikveh in which thousands of Khazars had streamed down to the Atil by night, stripped naked, and submerged themselves in the holy water. Esther imagined the scene, the riverbank thronged with bodies, dark, wet heads as numerous as tadpoles glinting in the moonlight. What a mikveh could do to body and spirit was as close to magic as most ordinary Jews believed possible.
Emily Barton reading from The Book of Esther, published by Tim Dugan Books, a division of Crown. When you decide on this character and this world, do you set parameters for yourself in the sense of, okay, I'll go this far in this fantastical world, but I don't want to get involved in this, or this?
Well, you know what's funny about that is that one makes mistakes in deciding where to stop. There were so many things that I did one way and then tried a different way in a later draft. One of the things is that I wanted to be, let's say, respectful of contemporary Jewish practice, even if there was an Orthodox reader reading the book. I would not want an Orthodox reader to see the way that they practice Judaism in this book and to say, oh, that seems offensive to me in any way. At the same time, if the Khazars had made it to the present day, if their empire hadn't fallen in the Dark Ages, and if it had continued to exist up until Hitler's time, I'm guessing that their Judaism would be a little bit different from ours, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, they would have evolved separately. So trying to think of ways in which that could happen and at the same time be respectful of the real world is a kind of an ongoing process from draft to draft.
Now, Esther is prohibited from entering the war effort because she is a woman. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of feminism in this book. Do you think of that initially as a theme that you want to explore, or does that come through the writing of this character in a rather natural sense?
I knew from the get-go that I wanted the hero of this book to be a woman, and that's partly just because as a Jewish woman, you know, I'm interested in what that role means or can mean to different people. She immediately sprang into my mind that there would be a girl hero and that she would have a little boy sidekick, partly because, you know, in my mind, I thought I was writing this potboiler and I thought that would be a fun potboilery way to do it. But, you know, 4 days later, when I had laid the potboiler idea to bed and realized that I was writing an actual novel, I was still interested in writing her from a woman's point of view. And this is partly because I'm myself a woman, and it's partly because when I'm reading, I really enjoy so much seeing strong and nuanced and fully realized women characters going about their business in the world. So I definitely knew that I wanted her to be herself from the get-go, but how she actually evolved, of course, I discovered as I wrote her from scene to scene and then also from draft to draft.
And as she goes out on her own, this is where the mechanical horse comes in, we should note. And the boy is her adopted brother.
Mm-hmm.
What is there about that dynamic? Because it's a very fun dynamic to read about.
Well, when I began writing it, I thought that she would have only an adopted brother, that Itach, the little boy character, would just be her adopted brother. But as I continued to write, I realized that one of the preoccupations that this book has is with the ways that people divide themselves from one another. In all kinds of ways and at all levels in this book, people are noticing divisions between different kinds of people, different classes of people, and then also working to cross those imaginary dividing lines. And in thinking about that and in thinking about whether various creatures in the book, Salema, the mechanical horse, Nagahan, the pigeon who does pigeon post for them, you know, wondering what kinds of rights and beinghood those characters had made me think that maybe he could have a more liminal status, that in addition to being an adopted brother, he could be the family's beloved house slave in a kind of sense of slavery that's not exactly the way we understand it in our world. It gave me an opportunity to look at another kind of division between people and at the ways that people might be able to cross it.
I know I've asked this question to other fantasy authors, and I've always been fascinated by the response, but is there almost a grieving process when you leave this world because the rules that you have created for that world then no longer apply to the next thing you write?
That's such an interesting question, and not really for me. I mean, I'm sure that some people have said yes to that question.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy making worlds, and I enjoy making them fully and really trying to create them in a way that you, the reader, feel like you're part of the imaginative enterprise of building the world. And then I want to walk away and do another project. So I really enjoyed being in this world with these characters. And at the same time, I'm excited to move on to whatever the next thing will be.
So I know even in talking to writers of history who say that they will be in the world of Abraham Lincoln or in the world of Churchill, and then suddenly you leave that world and they stay with you. So does this, especially considering it does have a centerpiece to your own religion, that does it stay with you at a point?
It really does, and in partly just on the level of as we sit here and talk about the book together, I realize why it's hard for me right now to get fully invested in another project, mm-hmm. because the kind of the tendrils of this world are still kind of latching on to me a little bit. But I know that as time goes on, I mean, literal time, as I get farther from the day when I completed this book, that there will be more imaginative room to kind of dip into the next thing.
What is it, do you think, that we enjoy about fantasy, about a created world, about something that we cannot imagine, but we turn over to you as a storyteller to lay out for us?
I think there are a few different things that we find really satisfying about that process. For me as a reader, I always enjoy seeing how somebody else's imagination is different from mm-hmm. my own. I enjoy seeing the leaps and even just the simple logical processes that somebody else's imagination takes when creating something. That is a total delight to me as a reader. I think that when I'm reading fantasy or sci-fi or alternate worlds, I enjoy looking at the kind of layered way that that world is completely itself and also reflects on our world and also reflects on real history or other alternate futures, as may be the case. I find that very enjoyable. And then for me as a reader, and when I'm thinking about who my reader might be, I really enjoy the collaborative enterprise of being a part of making that world with the author, or if I'm the writer, with the reader. I enjoy the way that the writer goes a certain distance in creating that world, but the rest of it is left up to the reader's imagination. And that process of envisioning things, whether as the writer or as the reader, is so enjoyable to me.
And it becomes more escapist than other genres, doesn't it?
I guess it can in certain respects, or it can bring you right back to where you're standing.
Yeah.
It can be either way. I think it really depends on the narrative.
Sure. But sometimes we want that escapist.
Absolutely. I do not deny it.
We crawl into a book because we want to be brought somewhere else.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is very delightful.
It certainly is. When you think of this world, and I could even ask this question in your past novels, do you think of them fondly?
I do think of them very fondly. I have tremendous fondness for the worlds and for these characters that I've created. And I mean, I hope that readers will too. You hope that when you're writing a book, that a reader will feel invested in it, that the reader will really care what happens to this world and to these people.
Emily Barton's new novel, The Book of Esther, is published by Tim Dugan Books, a division of Crown. Emily, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
Thank you. Again, the name of the new novel is The Book of Esther. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.